Hello and welcome to another episode of the My Control Room podcast, the only podcast that features discussion, commentary, and tips regarding control room ergonomics, alarm management, human factor interface, and much more. On today's episode, Ian Nimmo, president of User Center Design Services, is going to be talking about alarm management.
Let's talk a little bit about alarm management and why is it still an issue after, I guess, over 20-odd years of focus groups and multiple standards and multiple guidelines on this issue. Why can't people seem to come to terms with what's the solution for it and fix it? And is it possible, I guess, is probably one of the first questions we should ask. Is this something that's achievable? And let me first of all say that, yes, it is achievable. We have numerous customers who we've worked with who are now performing at the recommended guidelines for alarm management. Their performance figures are what was predicted in the guidelines, and their systems have allowed their operators to become proactive rather than reactive, which is what a lot of alarms has done. It's made operators just reactive. So how do we do that, and what is the solution? And what we've found is that, yes, there's guidelines or regulations out there that do things like suggest an alarm philosophy, but most companies, what they've done is they've had an alarm philosophy written for them, and then they put it on the bookshelf and never use it. And it's not changed anything. It doesn't change the way they look at their alarms or they rationalize their alarms or anything else. The way they go about rationalizing their alarms is sort of like, what's the quick fix? Is this just a filtering problem? Is it just a bad instrument? Is it really required as an alarm? And not a lot of thought into, well, what about the rest that should be there that the philosophy talked about documenting the alarm, helping the operator understand what the cause and effects are and what the operator responses should be for a particular alarm, and all those things documented for every alarm. And most customers see that and they sort of say, oh, that's a lot of work. Well, yes, it is. But when you've done it, it's something that brings tenfold benefits when you do that. When we see bad alarm management systems, what we perceive is that, first of all, that they haven't really followed a good concept about what is an alarm. So there's a lot of debate about, is this alarm working in normal operations? In other words, it's just telling you something's happened. That you know, it has no response, which shouldn't be an alarm, or is it something that's bad and you still have time to do something about it, or is something bad happened and it's just told you that something bad's happened and there's nothing you can do about it? I mean, that's a useless alarm. The ones we're really interested in are the ones that allow the operator to be proactive and get there before the consequences occur and fix the problem, and making sure that the operator has sufficient time to do that. So when we talk about sufficient time to do that, it means that for any alarm that comes up in the system, whether there's multiple alarms coming up, that the operator can get to all of them in a timely manner and actually deal with them. And what we see today is that operators just get overwhelmed and they just give up and sort of say, well, I can't do any of those things, so I'll just do what I think is the best thing to do, and just ignore the prioritization of the alarms. So one of the things that we see is that alarms are not configured correctly. Nobody puts a lot of thought into what the set point of the alarm should be. And when we do analysis, we find that some alarms could never, ever possibly come in, either they're too high or too low. And the process never operates in those regions, so the alarm would never operate. Or we find completely the opposite. The alarm is always in because it's always within the operating envelope of the process, So those become useless alarms just because of inadequate design. So it's a little bit about configuring it correctly, setting the alarm set points correctly, and then doing what I talked about earlier, which is some dynamic alarming, so that if you do get a piece of equipment that trips, the associated alarms for it are also suppressed because that piece of equipment's no longer running, right? And all these other things are telling you is that things are not running, and we know it's not running. Once we know it's not running, the rest of the alarms are irrelevant. So we use some dynamic tools to automatically shelve those alarms and stop them from clouding other issues, because with the processing plant, what you often get is this domino effect where one piece of equipment goes down, which impacts the next piece of equipment, and the alarms for that next piece of equipment start going off, and then there's this, domino effect as it passes on through different pieces of equipment. And the operator knows the root cause. He's got to get his flows back to stop those alarms coming in. He can't do that until he's fixed the original problem with that first piece of equipment. So we have to try and make some sense of all of that and help the operator be able to separate out what's real and what's not real. And, you know, I think one of the things that we see is that we put a lot of that information in philosophies and people don't read it and don't use it. What we've been endeavoring to do recently is to write a procedure, and that procedure describe what are the main activities you must go through during the rationalization process, and making sure people follow that procedure. And we're extracting from the philosophy document the most important points about alarm set point, about how to prioritize alarm, what is an alarm, you know, when should you say, okay, this is no longer an alarm, it should just be a notification. How do we configure that alarm? And there's two different types of alarms. There's what we call highly managed alarms, and there's normal alarms. Now, highly managed alarms are ones that are more safety critical, and they require some understanding. And for every safety-related alarm, there should be a safety case. And that means there's got to be some form of either LOPA study, where there's some form of risk analysis being done, and then you're understanding what's the risk reduction you're getting by adding this alarm, what's the contribution to safety, and how should it be tested, what's the frequency of the testing. All that should be documented about the alarm. So when you have a highly managed alarm, there's a lot more things you need to do than with a regular alarm. And unfortunately, a lot of people have just thrown highly managed alarms into regular alarms, and they don't do any testing, they don't do any maintenance on them, they don't do any risk analysis or understanding what the risk reduction part of this alarm is. It gets to this point where you sort of say, well, you have an expectation that if this alarm goes off, an operator is going to respond to it within a minute to prevent the consequences of this alarm. Yet you have full knowledge that the operator takes 20-minute breaks, he goes to the bathroom for 10 minutes, he has three-quarters of an hour for lunch where he's not sat at his desk, he walks around the control room, goes to other consoles and talks to people, and he could not get back in time to make that response. So you either have to automate the response, or you have to understand what are the limitations of the operator and his ability to be able to respond to that and prevent the consequences. And so you have to be realistic as well as you're selecting some of these things for alarms. It's not magic, right? It's about prioritizing, making sure the operator has the physical time to respond to it, and that the operator knows what to do when it comes up. And that's a big thing. If he doesn't know what to do and he just looks at it and says, well, I've never seen that before, it's useless. And we basically need to be training them on all the priority one alarms, the highest priority alarms and the critical alarms, and making them so that they stand out from everything else. In the past, we've had major issues with the use of color, for example. So in the industry, on our HMIs, we had really three or four dominant colors that were always used, and they were used for multiple things, things like red, yellow, green, and you know, you may be say orange or blue, whatever. But they were used for multiple things. So like the color red was used for 13 different coding things, like open valves closed or motors not running or whatever. But it was also used for the highest priority alarm. So when you looked at the screen, when the alarm came on the screen was already full of red. And to introduce red was not really a big deal for somebody to be able to spot what's going on. So we've made some mistakes in that area. So today we have rules around reserving alarm colors. So the color red is only ever used for the highest priority alarm. If ever you see red on a screen, something bad's happening. In the past, it was things like, this pump's not running, but it isn't supposed to be running. Well, that's normal, so why are you using the color red for something that's normal? And we just developed these practices of using reds and greens, and plus reds and greens from a human factors perspective is a bad choice anyway, because those are the two colors that the most dominant colorblind person can't distinguish. It's red and green. So why did we use those as our two main coding systems together when we should have avoided them? They're used in this, together. So using for things like running or stopped is a bad practice. And we have other ways of coding to get around that. And so we've had to limit the use of colors and reserve alarm colors for just alarms. And that's been a good practice, and it's really helped the industry and operators to understand and detect new problems. We did a paper just recently called Alarms Revisited, and that's available for anybody who would like a copy of it. Just write into us and we'll send you a copy. But in Alarms Revisited, what we try to address are, what are some of the common failures? Why aren't people achieving these goals and actually getting themselves to what, there's a document called a MEO 191, which I participated in the writing of it, and we contributed through the SM Consortium funding to get that document out. And it really has the benchmark for what does good look like. And apart from just showing what good looks like, it also shows you the progression to extremes from this is about the worst you could be, right? And this is how you improve in stages, and it gives you the KPI figures. So you can look at your KPIs and put yourself into one of five boxes and sort of say, well, we're here, we're stable, but we're not where we want to be, which is predictive. And there's a couple of steps to get from stable to predictive, but it's in the reduction of frequency of alarms, etc., that's going to get us there. And so what do we have to do to get there? And say sometimes you get to the point where you've done all you think you can do, and you have to start introducing some new techniques like dynamic alarming to get you down to the next stages of where the KPIs are pushing you. So again, we invest our time in tools to help the operator be able to detect, diagnose, and respond to alarms. So this is Ian Nimmo with User-Centered Design Services. I'm the president of the company. We have a lot of experience in alarm management. If you would like further information, we have details on our website of papers that have been done in the past on alarm management. A good one for you to review first would be our Alarm Revisited paper, which covers some of the main topics of importance today. But we also, if you would like to have a good philosophy or like us to review your philosophy and make some recommendations on maybe what could be improved and how it becomes more practical just for the rationalization team to use, please drop us a line, or all our contact details are on our website, mycontrolroom.com. And any one of us will be glad to help you and give you more information.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the My Control Room podcast. For more information on Ian and user-centered design services, please visit mycontrolroom.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.